Nuclear hot seat. What are those people thinking? Nuclear hot seat. What have those boys been drinking? Nuclear hot seat. The corium is sinking. Our time to act is shrinking, but our activists are linking. Nuclear hot seat. It's the bomb.
Welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat, the weekly international news magazine keeping you up to date on all things anti-nuclear. My name is Libby Halevi. I'm the producer and host, as well as a survivor of the nuclear accident at Three Mile Island from just 1 mile away. So I know what can happen when the nuclear experts get it wrong. This week, we talk with Dennis Riches, based in Japan and a blogger at Nuclear Free by 2045. We have a nice conversation about the art of self-deception as practiced by Tokyo Electric Power Company. Then Michael Leonardi of the Toledo Coalition for Safe Energy and the Coalition Against Nukes talks about his experience testifying at the Canadian hearings on the proposed nuclear waste dump that Canada wants to build less than 1 mile from Lake Huron, and all that pure drinking water. On the ground reporting from activists on opposite sides of the world. This coming up in just a few moments, along with radiation protection tip, numbnuts of the week for nuclear boneheadedness, and much more. Today is Wednesday, October 1st, 2013, and here is the week's anti-nuclear news. Starting out with what seems like a good message coming out of the Food and Drug Administration here in the United States. Their mantra since 2011 has been that Fukushima contamination is something that we really don't need to worry about. Their quote is, "To date, no evidence that radionuclides from the Fukushima incident are present in the U.S. food supply at levels that would pose a public health concern. They never let me decide what level of radiation I should be concerned about. There is a vast range between no radiation in your food and the U.S. FDA interpretation of how much is too much." Now, it turns out, the U.S. has recently banned agricultural and fishing exports from 14 prefectures in Japan. This came out of Korea's top newspaper, Dong-A Ilbo, on September 28th. South Korea puts a similar ban on fishery imports from 8 prefectures, China for 10, and Taiwan for 5. However, this import alert, which was found on the FDA website on an industry-focused section, explains how the FDA is letting Japan decide what foods can or cannot get let into the U.S. food supply. Foods that are not banned by Japan apparently have unrestricted entry and don't require any testing by the FDA. Concerns about contamination in the U.S. food supply have been dismissed, even though contamination has been found in the U.S. food supply by independent testing. But since the levels are well below the FDA's intervention level, which is 12 times more than allowed in Japan, the FDA considers them not to matter. Tra-la, tra-la. Molly Martha Lightfoot, who is Dr. Helen Caldicott's number one woman in the United States, says, "The FDA alert is a non-binding statement of what they can do. It does not mean that they will do this." So, in other words, a lot of smoke and mirrors from the FDA. Regarding the radiation in the fish, Daniel Hirsch, a nuclear policy lecturer at the University of California, Santa Cruz, told Global Security Newswire, "Look what's going on. They're dumping huge amounts of radioactivity into the ocean. No one expected that in 2011. We could have large numbers of cancer from ingestion of fish." Further bad news from TEPCO, that on September 27th, they announced that they had detected 400,000 becquerels per liter of radioactive materials in a well near the reactor of Fukushima No. 1 and 2. So with thousands of gallons of radioactive effluent sluicing into the Pacific daily, you can't help but wonder if some of it is working its way up the marine food web and into your tuna salad. Mm-mm-mm. But according to the FDA, you don't have to worry. Much. The North Carolina Utilities Commission has continued its support for Duke Energy's business model of building dirty power plants and padding profits by gouging households and small businesses. That's because the commission approved another 5% rate hike, which places the financial burden of new power plants on residential and small business customers by allocating costs based on the single hottest hour of the year. Great gaming, guys. Further, Duke has repeatedly requested a guaranteed profit of 10.2%. Don't you wish you could do that, too? Over to Ohio, where they know darn well that nuclear is cracked. Specifically, Davis-Bessey is cracked. First Energy, the operator of the Ohio Davis-Bessey plant on Lake Erie, has found several more cracks in the containment building housing the nuclear reactor, and says some cracks found earlier have grown a bit. Ray Lieb, First Energy's vice president for Davis-Bessey, and clearly their spokesmodel on this, said the building is still safe. How long's your nose getting, Ray? First Energy is in the midst of seeking a 20-year renewal of Davis-Bessey's operating license, which expires in 2017. Michael Keegan, a spokesman for one of four anti-nuclear groups opposing the renewal, said the NRC's continued acceptance of First Energy studies of the Shield building should inspire little confidence. The structure is compromised, he said. Once again, First Energy puts profit above safety. Two Michigan lawmakers are speaking out against a Canadian proposal to store nuclear waste underground less than a mile from the shores of Lake Huron. State Senator Hoon Young Hopgood and Representative Sarah Roberts testified on Monday, September 30th, against Ontario Power Generation's plan to store roughly 200,000 cubic meters of low- and intermediate-level radioactive waste deep inside limestone caverns near its Bruce Nuclear Generating Station. In prepared testimony, Roberts said, "The bottom line is it is impossible to guarantee the geological integrity of the proposed location for the repository. There will always be unanticipated or unpredictable natural occurrences that take place." Hopgood criticized Ontario Power Generation for failing to consider alternative sites or extend its public outreach efforts to Michigan, arguing that all citizens who live near the Great Lakes have a right to know about the proposal and should have been consulted. Both of our interviews today address this problem, so stay tuned for more details. This is a runner-up for Numbnuts of the Week. Can't quite give it to them, but the Lawrence Livermore Lab, which should be the Lawrence Livermore Nuclear Lab, has put out a huge PR article on how their new nuclear technology is so much better than the old stuff. Why, as they say, quote, "Any radioactive waste products have a shorter half-life than those currently produced by nuclear reactors used today." Oh, like only 23,000 years of half-life instead of 24,000 years? No plutonium? No strontium? No cesium? Liver snacks. This is nuclear spin speak, the next generation of lies. Remember too cheap to meter? Our friend, the atom? Give it a rest. Go solar. Over to Japan, where the health news keeps getting worse. First of all, a shout out to activist Takahiro Katsumi, who has started compiling statistics based on tweets dealing with nosebleeds in Japan. What he discovered is that over 5,000 people were reported tweeting nosebleed, the word nosebleed, which is hanaji in Japanese, over a 2-day period from September 22nd to 23rd. He further discovered that over 2,000 people were reported tweeting "can't stop my nosebleed" during the week of September 20th through 27th. The tweeters were on average under age 30, most of them students in high school or college, and also new adults working part-time or full-time. They are suffering from recurring, massive, and enduring nosebleeding that is beginning to pose risks to their overall health by causing other symptoms such as low fever, headaches, nausea, and fatigue. Nosebleeds of this sort are consistent with exposure to radiation. Some of the tweeters report skipping school and work because of the nosebleeds. Takahiro is asking for help in compiling a database with this information. I'll be posting a link to his site on nuclearhotseat.com, Nuclear Hot Seat number 120. Weekly Asahi published a report that states that urine samples from children living in Kanto showed that 70% of those tested contained cesium, a radioactive element that results in internal exposure and that comes from damaged nuclear power plants such as Fukushima Daiichi. The Daily Beast recently obtained unpublished data on birth defects in Japan, which show a small increase in prevalence rates for 2011. Well, of course, it's still small because if babies were conceived before March 11, they would have been developing for a period of time where they weren't exposed to Fukushima's radiation. Any babies who were conceived after March 11 of 2011 had 9 months in utero and wouldn't have been born full term until the end of December, so the numbers would not have hit yet. What makes this documentation suspicious is that the university that conducted the study will not release regional figures. Since 1999, the Yokohama City University has been releasing the statistical report regularly around the month of May, but they did not publish the data this year. Only after repeated requests, it finally provided the 2011 data, which is still currently unavailable to the public. They would not release prefecture-by-prefecture data, even though nuclear experts inside and outside of the country assert that Japan needs to seriously measure the health impact of its nuclear problems, including birth defects, with not just annual data, but monthly data and broken down by prefecture. Alexei Yablokov, biologist and member of the Russian Academy of Scientists and one of the world's leading experts on Chernobyl, said, "The Japanese government is not trustworthy when it comes to releasing information about Fukushima, which is Japan's Chernobyl. The assertion that prefecture-specific data would not be useful is ridiculous. A real national comparative study needs to be conducted." And this story. Polydactyly is a condition in which a person has more than 5 fingers per hand or 5 toes per foot. It is a mutation. When a parent whose baby had been born with polydactyly contacted Fukushima Medical University to ask for an operation for their child, they were told that they were very busy operating on babies with the same condition and had more than 100 on their waiting list. The parents were also told they would have to wait another 1 to 2 years before the operation could be performed, as the bones in the fingers and hands needed to be well developed. So perhaps the operations that they are already conducting are on babies that were born after Fukushima with this birth defect. Over to TEPCO, which is always good for a laugh. Workers at the Fukushima nuclear power plant on Thursday, September 26, spotted a hole in one of the barriers intended to keep radioactive particles contained in the harbor. TEPCO set up silt fences in the harbor next to the plant, a device to trap sediment before water flows into the sea. But it does nothing to radioactive water. And it had a hole in it. On Tuesday, October 1st, workers spilled 4 tons of radioactive water into the soil. The accident occurred during the transfer of polluted rainwater from one of the plant's concrete gutters to an empty storage tank. Earlier on Tuesday, TEPCO said one of 3 units for injecting nitrogen into the damaged reactors shut down due to a worker mishandling the equipment. TEPCO injects nitrogen into the reactors to prevent explosions similar to those that rocked the site in the early days of the disaster. Fortunately, this nitrogen injecting unit has been restarted. Phew, I feel so much safer now. Here's a news flash only 2.5 years too late. The Japanese government has invited overseas companies and experts to submit technology proposals or advice for helping it resolve ongoing contaminated water issues at Fukushima Daiichi. The deadline for putting in these proposals is October 23rd. I've got the best suggestion possible. Put Arne Gunderson of fairwinds.org in charge. End of story. You don't know what I'm talking about? Check out Nuclear Hot Seat number 117 from September 10. You'll get an earful. So what is TEPCO's response to all of this bad news out of Fukushima?
Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Nuclear Hot Seat. Num Nuts of the Week.
That's right. It's Num Nuts time. TEPCO has made its first application to bring nuclear reactors back online.
They've now submitted information on the safety upgrades that they institute at the Kashiwazaki Kariwa 6 and 7 advanced boiling water reactor units in Niigata Prefecture. Right. Like, we believe anything TEPCO has to say about anything, let alone safety. Let history speak for itself. And that is why TEPCO is probably in danger of perpetually receiving the nuclear hot seat.
None nuts out a week!
Just a few international notes before our interviews. This out of South Korea. Short of calling the Japanese government a liar, South Korea's fisheries minister strongly blasted Japan on Monday, September 30th, for trying to downplay and cover up the now high-profile contaminated water leaks at the disaster-stricken Fukushima nuclear power plant. Yoon Jin-suk, South Korea's minister of oceans and fisheries, said that Japan as a country is without conscience or morality for hiding the leaks for so long before they were admitted by the government and utility operator Tokyo Electric Power Company. In Sweden, our favorite nuclear activists shut down one of Sweden's biggest nuclear power plants, the Eon SE. Who are our favorite activists? A swarm of jellyfish. They made their way into a cooling water inlet at the reactor on the Baltic coast, and the 1,400-megawatt Oskardom 3 unit went, shut down. Jellyfish. These special secret forces that may or may not be affiliated with Greenpeace. So I figure, if a spineless jellyfish can shut down a nuclear reactor, so can the rest of us. And finally, this indication out of Bloomberg that maybe the media is finally getting it right. In an interview with Vladimir Asmolov, first deputy director general of Rosenergoatom, the state-owned Russian nuclear utility, he said, in our globalized nuclear industry, we don't have national accidents. They are all international. To which Bloomberg added, before Fukushima, Chernobyl was ranked as the world's worst nuclear accident. They stopped the statement there and didn't quite declare in mainstream media that Fukushima was the worst. But we're getting there. Come on, who gets to say it first? New York Times, CNN, Susanna Frame up at King 5 in Seattle. Somebody. We'll let you know who breaks that barrier first. Okay, two interviews today. Dennis Riches is a Canadian-born resident of Japan who lives near Tokyo, about 200 kilometers, 120 miles, directly south of Fukushima. Since the disaster began 2.5 years ago, he has been a local activist and extremely articulate blogger at his site, Nuclear Free by 2045. I spotted one of his blog posts going viral and couldn't resist talking to this articulate embedded witness to Japan's nuclear situation. We spoke in late August.
Dennis Riches, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you for having me on.
Give us an idea of where you live in Japan, how long you've been there, and how you got there.
Yeah, well, I first came to Japan back in the 1980s and stayed for a couple of years, just in the post-Chernobyl days. And I learned a little bit about the anti-nuclear movement at that time, and there were some good books and brochures published by the anti-nuclear groups here, published in English. And that was sort of one of my reasons for wanting to leave at the time. But I just forgot that good common sense, I guess, and I came back in 1994. And I've been here since then, working in various universities and colleges as an English teacher. I got married here in 1996, and we had three children after that. So we're, when Fukushima happened, we were sort of smack in the middle of raising three little kids, which was quite stressful.
Let's talk about that time. Mm-hmm. It sounds like while you were aware of the anti-nuclear movement, you really weren't involved with it before Fukushima. Is that accurate?
Yeah, that's true. I was busy raising kids and working and just always put it out of my mind and hoped it would never happen. I was aware of the dangers, though. Everybody, I think, here was at some level.
What was it like when the earthquake, tsunami, and shortly thereafter the nuclear disaster began? How did that impact you and your family?
Yeah, we had an interesting experience of it because we were in Toronto at the time. I was just finishing a one-year leave from my work. And so we woke up one morning and saw it all happening on the news. And we were preparing to come back here at the end of March when we decided to keep the children in Canada a little bit longer until we knew exactly which way this was going to go. Right now, they're 15, 13, and 10.
Did you think at all to stay in Canada and not come back, or to take much longer to do so?
Oh, yeah, we fought with that decision for a few weeks. But, you know, our lease was up in Canada, and we had to just pile in and live with my sister for a couple weeks. And I came back to work 2 weeks late. But, yeah, they did come back after things settled down and things seemed to be stabilized. And we knew that the reactor 4 spent fuel pool was stable for the time being. We decided to come back and give it a try here.
What changes did you find in your local community? And were there any dangers? Were people upset? Did anybody evacuate?
I live in Narita City, which is Tokyo's airport city, just about 60 kilometers northeast of the city. And we're 200 kilometers south of Fukushima Daiichi. So a lot of people from Fukushima evacuated to this area if they had relatives or friends here. And our neighbor across the street had his cousin and his family come down. They were actually employees of one of the companies that worked for TEPCO up in Fukushima. So he was in a really difficult spot. As somebody who had earned his living from the nuclear plant, he suddenly had to get his family out and keep them away for a few weeks.
What was the impact on local life? Did things change? Did they go back to normal really quickly? Were people obsessed with the information? Were they ignoring it? How did it play out?
Well, I found around here, we live in a very suburban area, and a lot of people have young children. And for the first couple of weeks, everybody was talking about it. But then after that, nobody wanted to talk about it anymore. They wanted to get back to normal, and it's been that way ever since. I think I was probably the person most concerned in the neighborhood. And I was out with my Geiger counter looking for hot spots in the neighborhood, and I did find a few, but nobody wanted to talk about those either.
What about the media? What about the information that you were getting? Was there any reason to suspect it, or did it sound like they were saying the right things and you were getting the information and you could really step away from the panic?
Well, I noticed after a couple of weeks, everybody and the media seemed to realize that the electric companies were not going to be having a lot of money to sponsor advertising in the media anymore. So the fear of criticizing them seemed to disappear. And during the crisis, there was an opening there where a lot of reporters took chances and NHK put out some good documentaries. You know, and a lot of the information I get from my blog is from the mainstream media, so I can't really say there's been a big cover-up or anything. I think mostly it's just the general public is busy and distracted, and a lot of people just don't want to think about it too much.
Obviously, you've been thinking about it because you have incredibly articulate posts in your blog that, in extensive articles, weave together information in some truly insightful ways. And I'm wondering, what moved you to write the blog, and when did you get started with it?
I got started, I think, during the summer break from work, 2011. I just started writing it, and I found I was exchanging a lot of emails with friends. They just got really long and involved in citing sources, so I thought, well, I'm not going to write this individually for different people. I'll just put up a blog, and it took off from there.
What got me to want to talk with you for this interview was a blog post. I was not aware of you until I saw this one go around, but it was about deception and self-deception and how it has played out in the nuclear industry and specifically around the Fukushima accident. Talk to us a little bit about these observations that you had and how this piece came together.
Oh, I'd like to give credit to the inspiration I got from Robert Trivers. He's an evolutionary psychologist that works at Rutgers University. And he did a lot of the early work in evolutionary psychology in the 1970s, 80s. And he wrote this book, I think it came out in 2011, just after the Fukushima crisis. He mentions it briefly in the last chapter of his book. But he really got into the psychology of self-deception, how it works at an individual level, and how it works in institutions.
Tell us a little bit more about that, especially how it happens with nuclear institutions, how it has played out.
Yeah, well, he talked about NASA, and when he described these examples from NASA and the investigations into the Challenger and the Columbia disasters, how problems were ignored for years and years, and the need to maintain budgets and maintain the program and maintain jobs took precedence over safety concerns. So that got me thinking of it. It just sounds a lot like what we see in the nuclear industry, particularly in the case of Fukushima with TEPCO. There were so many times they just ignored safety issues and lapses in their own safety culture.
Explain the process that Trivers set out about how someone moves from deceit to self-deceit and what that means.
From an evolutionary standpoint, he was saying that if you're going to lie to someone and make it convincing, the best way to do it is to lie to yourself and make that convincing so that you're not even consciously aware of the lie after a certain time. It's just become a part of you and it's buried. And this can happen too within institutions where there's just an instinctive avoidance of certain questions, certain topics and issues that threaten the agenda.
In other words, institutional ass covering.
Yes, but perhaps not even happening at a conscious level.
Do you think that that is the case of what's been happening in Japan and what happened with TEPCO?
I believe so. It's hard to say for sure, you know, about these things. You just end up making your own judgment and evaluation. But certainly the list goes on and on of, you know, the lapses in the safety culture that occurred long before Fukushima. There were major scandals several times from the 1990s onwards.
With TEPCO specifically?
Yes, with TEPCO and other nuclear utilities as well.
One of the quotes from your article, and this seems to be really relevant as regards TEPCO, is, "Once a person has committed to an errant path, evidence of mistakes will not be sought, and if they are found, they will be repressed. The farther the person goes, the worse the self-deception gets. The situation may seem appalling to outside observers, but the travelers on the path will delude himself or put on a brave face."
Yeah, that's right. And it gets to a point where outside observers see the discrepancies and it just becomes kind of absurd to try to deal with. And if you're in a hierarchy, the lower people who might be able to see these contradictions are, of course, afraid to speak up.
So it becomes institutionalized up and down the chain of command, and nobody's going to say that the emperor is naked.
That's right. After I wrote the piece, I added the quotation at the top, which comes from Moby Dick. I found that quite interesting to see that a writer from the 19th century had the same insights into human psychology. Herman Melville wrote in Moby Dick, the voice of Ishmael here heading off to his journey. He said, "If I had been downright honest with myself, I would have seen very plainly in my heart that I did but half fancy being committed this way to so long a voyage, without once laying my eyes on the man who was to be absolute dictator of it, so soon as the ship sailed out upon the open sea. But when a man suspects any wrong, it sometimes happens that if he be already involved in the matter, he insensibly strives to cover up his suspicions, even from himself. And much this way it was with me. I said nothing and tried to think nothing."
That's as relevant today as it was when it was first written. And I love the literary comparison because literature can teach us so much.
Mm-hmm.
So as regards these ongoing deceptions, this downward spiral of lies and self-lies and institutional lies, we come to the recent past, the last 2 weeks or so out of Japan, where the news has become progressively worse, and I don't believe it's over yet, about TEPCO first saying it's leaking more than we've been admitting to. Gee, it's been leaking for the last 27 months, putting it at first a level one and now a level three, though there are good reasons to argue that the level should be much higher than that. But how have these ongoing revelations been received in your community and the people you know in Japan? Has it perhaps snapped them out of their lethargy?
I really don't think they'll have much to say. They're just fearful and they shrug and scratch their heads. And I think they keep all their fears private. It's a really common trait of people here. Maybe it is everywhere.
Do you think it might be cultural?
It is to a certain extent, but I think you'll see that anywhere where this kind of natural hazard exists.
So you're not aware of any changes, at least in your immediate environment, as a result of the awareness that 300 tons of highly radioactive water has gone into the Pacific Ocean?
No, I haven't heard much about it. You hear the outrage in the media. It's being reported well here, but people don't talk around the water cooler or, you know, around the neighborhood about these things. It's kind of unusual here.
What kind of information has been coming out behind the revelations that have been making the headlines that maybe we have not been aware of?
Well, one interpretation I liked, I read it a couple of weeks ago, was an interview on Russia Today with Chris Busby. And he noted that, ever since the accident happened, experts knew right away that water was going to be the main deal. Water's going to flow, underground through the natural sources. They're going to have to pump cooling water, which will overflow. And he said at that time, back in 2011, it all goes to the ocean. And his recent interview, he pointed this out, that he pointed it out earlier, and he's saying there's really not much they can do now to avoid having these big discharges into the ocean. And also that every expert in the world knew this was the reality. So you have to wonder if these recent apologies and statements coming out from TEPCO were just planned years ahead. They just realized it's better to not talk about this now. We'll apologize for it when we're forced to.
I think the apologies have been somewhere south of lame. Other than them saying, oh, gee, we're sorry we did this, I think it was the president and the number two person in TEPCO have said, and we are giving up our salary for a month, which makes no sense. It has no relationship to reality. It's not even accurately symbolic of anything. Do you get the sense that they think this is actually going to manage the problem, or at least the PR problem that they have with this?
Yeah, it might work for some people. I know that's the traditional response here whenever a scandal happens. Somebody offers to give up his bonus or take a pay cut or something. Or they force the pay cut on the rank and file workers who aren't to blame. Yeah, it's really illogical. It's not attacking the problem at all. I think maybe they should take one of the robots, which haven't done any good in cleaning up the mess. They should just program one of those robots to bow and apologize all the time.
Have you heard any word from the inside as to what's been going on behind the scenes? Is there anything you can add to that?
No, not really. I'm just sitting here in my room most of the time in Narita, and not really well connected to any insiders or so on. And the one person I know working inside the nuclear industry in Canada isn't allowed to talk about much. He's not permitted to make an announcement to the media.
He's not allowed to speak about Fukushima?
Or anything really related to his work. It's all left to the media branches of the companies.
You know, they've got this thing rigged and wired and gamed 12 ways to Sunday, and certainly they've had decades of experience in how to do it and how to put their pieces in place, especially when it comes to the talking points. We'll keep checking back with you to see if there are any other updates you can provide on Fukushima and what's happening as these revelations about the disaster continue. But you've also addressed some very interesting topics in your blog, in other entries that you've done. And I was wondering if you could talk about them for a while. Specifically, there are two that I have in mind. The first one has to do with American Atomics and what they were trying to do to build a facility in the Detroit area. How did that come about?
Yeah, I just found a very brief news item a few weeks ago mentioning, right after the Detroit bankruptcy was announced, there was news about this new group of investors who are launching fourth generation small modular reactors using fast breeder technology. And they had this quite large scale offer ready to go to Detroit, offering eventually 100,000 jobs, cheap energy, and billions of dollars of manufacturing investment. And it was coming from an operation called American Atomics, who seemed to be deliberately keeping a low profile in the media. You'd think if they really wanted to, they could, if the news was so great, they could make this big news. But they seemed to be taking a low profile. I just tried to follow up on that and did some web searches and found out that a couple weeks later, Detroit had abruptly refused the offer for reasons not given. And the only reason given on the American Atomics website was that space was an issue. Detroit wasn't willing to offer the space that they required. So they're looking elsewhere.
I think this is remarkable because, as you pointed out in your article, Detroit's in bankruptcy. It is a city in total decay. It's in the process of falling down. here they are offered with what a chamber of commerce would usually jump at because it would bring jobs, it would bring money and all the rest. And Detroit had the good sense to turn it down. I think that is remarkable.
And ironically, Detroit is the place where America experimented with fast breeder technology. And they had a near catastrophic meltdown there in 1966, I think it was. And it was the subject of a book called We Almost Lost Detroit. So I guess people in Detroit still remember that and are a little bit allergic to any similar offer.
Sounds like they had a good dose of common sense.
Mm-hmm.
I know that another area that you are concerned about has to do with the land around the Great Lakes. Tell us a little bit about what your awarenesses have been about that, because you brought up some very interesting aspects of the problem that I was not previously aware of.
There's always surprises when you start investigating nuclear history. You find out this information is easy to get, but you wonder, why does nobody know about it? Why doesn't it get covered by the mainstream media more often? It's just kind of been hidden away in plain sight. But I'm from Toronto, and so I love the Great Lakes, and I got interested in this one. And I think I was led to it by the concern for Ontario's plan to bury nuclear waste near Lake Huron. And that led me to another site that's already existed there for decades. It's just off the Niagara River in Lewiston, New York. And it's a dumping ground for high-level radioactive waste from the Manhattan Project. This high-grade uranium ore from Africa, which was used to build the nuclear weapons that hit Nagasaki and Hiroshima. These wastes were treated and dumped in Lewiston, New York, and the last disposal solution was made in the mid-90s, I think. But it's really not satisfactory. There's a danger of future leaks going on.
Are they in tanks? Is it something akin to what they did at Hanford, which of course is leaking now as well? But is that the system that they used there?
It's just been a large pit, which was, I think, sealed with concrete, but not nearly good enough to be a long-term permanent solution. It was, I think, left that way in the hope that, you know, within the next couple of decades, future generations would get around to a long-term solution.
You know, one of the first interviews I did on Nuclear Hot Seat was with a man who was a nuclear engineer who'd actually been involved in the field almost since the beginning. He was a very old man. I asked him all of my naive questions, and one of them was, if they knew nuclear waste was going to be a problem for so long, why did they continue to build facilities? And he said something very interesting. He said that the engineers that were involved with it assumed at the time that something would be invented in technology to take care of it before it would become a problem.
Yeah, like some vain hope that there'd be transmutation or something.
Or that the Roy process would actually exist and we could get our hands on the formula and start knocking those electrons off and neutralizing the radioactivity. Mm-hmm. Nobody knows where the paperwork is on that, but it sure is a good concept if somebody could come up with it. I think that's where Bill Gates should put his money. Bill Gates and Warren Buffett should put up $100 million for whoever comes up with not only the theory, but the practical usage, the practical implementation to get rid of the danger from nuclear by neutralizing the waste. Then it might even be a technology that could be used, but until and unless that happens, it's a death sentence.
Yeah, one thing I suggested in that article was why not a moratorium on new construction of nuclear facilities until the waste issue is dealt with? And I think, of course, that won't happen because people would realize it's so expensive and impossible.
That's
right
actually
now.
The law here in California, that no more new nuclear sites can be built until there is a permanent solution to the waste problem. And with that not having happened, we've had a moratorium for all this time, and now we're down to the two reactors at Diablo and take an aim on that.
Yeah, that's a bit of good news. Somebody's got a sensible policy.
So, Dennis, as we move forward on this, where are you putting your attention next? And where can we find this wonderful blog of yours?
Well, I started this blog one day when I hadn't even done much checking around to see what other anti-nuclear sites were out there. And I just named it Nuclear Free by 2045, 2045, 100 years after the first nuclear bombs were dropped. So that's sort of my wish for the world. Maybe I'll live that long and see it happen. But I think that's a reasonable timeline to wind it all down if we really got serious about doing it. So my website is just called NF2045.blogspot.com.
And, of course, I will have that up on the website, nuclearhotseat.com/blog. Thank you so much for being on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you very much.
That was Dennis Riches, living in Japan and blogging at Nuclear Free by 2045. Found online at nf2045.blogspot.jp. And yes, there will be a link to that up on our website. Interesting that Dennis spoke of the Great Lakes nuclear problems because my second guest today, Michael Leonardi, is with the Toledo Coalition for Safe Energy and the Coalition Against Nukes. He recently attended a hearing on Ontario Power Generation's plans to build the first of two underground storage facilities for radioactive waste less than a mile from the shores of Lake Huron in Kincardine, Ontario.
Michael Leonardi, welcome to Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you.
First of all, you are a resident of Toledo, Ohio, which is on Lake Erie. What has gotten you involved with the Lake Huron Depository?
Apart from the fact that my family has had a home on Lake Huron, so I've been going there my entire life and feel very closely tied to Lake Huron in particular, Lake Erie gets around 90% of its water from Lake Huron. And Lake Erie's water empties faster than any of the other five Great Lakes every 2.5 years or so. So every 2.5 years, Lake Erie has a new water supply that's over 90% of comes down from Lake Huron through the St. Lawrence River and then Lake St. Clair, which isn't considered one of the five Great Lakes, but is a very large lake in and of itself, and then down through the Detroit River to Lake Erie. So all of these Great Lakes are interconnected, and it's a very intertwined ecosystem, you could say. So we're seeing that there are communities along both Lake Erie in Michigan and the tributaries that come down from Lake Huron, as well as communities now in Ohio that are very concerned about the idea of siting nuclear waste on Lake Huron. And we're seeing that local city governments and state governments are passing resolutions in opposition to the dump.
Hearings began with local communities on this proposed nuclear waste dump in Kincardine, Ontario, which is less than a mile, meaning about a kilometer, 0.6 of a mile from Lake Huron. Now, you were scheduled to be a speaker last week, but I understand that you had quite a conversation beforehand. We covered this on last week's Nuclear Hot Seat, but would you fill us in briefly with what happened to you in advance of your opportunity to testify?
In advance of my testifying up in Kincardine, I actually made the trip from Toledo because my family's house is about 100 kilometers south of there, and I felt so motivated that I decided to go in person. But prior to testifying in this hearing, I was called maybe 3 weeks beforehand by the Ontario Provincial Police one day. And I was really surprised and a bit put off by the phone call. Just a friendly police officer called and said that they were interested in making sure that there were no dangerous situations created around this public hearing, and he wanted to know from me whether or not I knew of any possible protests that might be arising. And I said, look, this is a public hearing that's going to be spread out over a couple-month period, and I don't think that I know of there are any protests planned. But I said, is this common protocol? I was put off immediately, despite the very friendly demeanor of the officer. I found it an intimidation tactic. And he mentioned to me by name the organization Greenpeace. And he said, well, we know that there's organizations that are very passionate, groups like Greenpeace, and we just don't want to make sure that there are no fatalities. And so he said we would be...
I'm sorry. It's just so ludicrous that those of us who are on the side of peace are being accused of wanting to perpetrate fatalities because we're protesting a nuclear waste dump. That just goes off the bizarre meter.
That wasn't his... I mean, his perspective wasn't that we were going to necessarily cause a fatality, but that somebody could be injured if we were protesting on a roadway that had a fast traffic, for example. He said that the Ontario Provincial Police would rather shut down a roadway for a couple hours to allow us to protest than they would have the risk of anybody getting hurt. That was his perspective on that. But then what I did, I looked into the situation and found out that indeed all the folks from Canada that were scheduled to testify had home visits by Ontario police officers. And this became quite a controversy and has continued to linger as a controversy around these hearings. There have been feature articles in the Toronto Star about it, the most circulated newspaper in Canada. And so it did get a lot of attention, and people were very concerned that this was not common protocol, and it was kind of being used as an intimidation factor. Although none of the activists seem to have been intimidated at all.
I wouldn't expect them to be. We're made of sterner stuff than that. You had a chance to actually speak at the hearing. Did you get a sense that there was fairness there? Did you feel railroaded? Was it managed? Was it manipulated? What's your take on how it went?
This is the second time that I have testified at a hearing in Canada with the Canadian Nuclear Safety Commission, and it reminded me very much like a Nuclear Regulatory Commission hearing. So I've tended to call for years from one of the great activists of this region, Mike Keegan, a dog and pony show, where there's really no democratic transparency in the proceedings. There's a three-judge panel. It's called a Joint Review Commission. They are appointed by Prime Minister Harper, who is a very pro-dirty energy industry kind of front man, worse than Bush, you could say.
And he's the Prime Minister of Canada now.
He's the Prime Minister of Canada. So he appointed this joint review panel. And I found that from researching the biographies of the three people on the panel, the chairwoman of the panel has worked in the past for the Canadian Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's the typical revolving door of industry / public servants in a bureaucratic manner. We had the Ontario Power Generation, which is a mixed private-public entity. OPG, the Ontario Power Generation, is an actual government body that is comprised of three private corporations, which operates the largest nuclear power plant operating today right now, which is the Bruce Nuclear Power Plant on the shores of Lake Huron, which is 8 reactors. They also operate a waste management facility there for all of Ontario's low-level radioactive waste, where they actually incinerate low-level radioactive waste, and they've been doing that for years, which is very detrimental to the surrounding environment and has released a lot of very dangerous radionuclides into the atmosphere. And there are growing numbers of cancerous tumors in that area that people have thought are possibly linked to this nuclear power plant.
Let's bring this back to the hearings. I take it you had a chance to speak and you lived through it. Nobody died. Did you have any sense that you were heard at all in the points that you were making?
The three judges looked at me sincerely throughout my testimony, and I feel as though, having researched a little bit, there have been so many testimonies over this process. It seems like they were maybe a little bit receptive to what I had to say, which was that I thought that the idea of siting a permanent low and intermediate nuclear waste dump less than a mile away from Lake Huron was absurd. But I don't have much confidence in this panel. I think that the only way that we are going to stop this dump is through international political pressure on the Canadian government coming from U.S. elected officials and U.S. citizens.
I understand that two Michigan state representatives just today testified in opposition to the dump.
That's correct. Today, two Michigan state legislators testified. One is Senator Hopgood, and another is a state representative, Sarah Roberts, both of whom have spoken out fervently and been part of community forums across southeastern Michigan in opposition to the dump. And they introduced legislation at the statewide level, which passed, opposing the siting of this dump. And their reason for this is that in the 1980s, there was an attempt to site a low-level radioactive waste dump in Michigan, and there was created what was called the Midwest Compact. I believe it was six states that were going to take turns siting low-level radioactive waste dumps in each of these states, and that eventually fell apart. And out of that, in 1987, there was a U.S. federal law passed that prohibited a nuclear dump of any kind from being sited within 10 miles of any Great Lake or Great Lake tributary. So this is violating existing U.S. law and existing Michigan law. So we feel that through international political pressure will be our best angle to stop this from happening.
And realistically speaking, how much say do you think the U.S. will have in whether the dump gets sited there or not?
I think that it will have a decent amount of say. We will see. There's a lot of interesting tensions going on between the United States and Canada, not only on the nuclear issue, but also on the Keystone Pipeline, for example. The Harper government has really been pushing the Obama administration and U.S. federal government to push through this pipeline as soon as possible, and it's been put on hold so far. So this could end up being some kind of bargaining chip. But usually there's a lot of cooperation with the Great Lakes government. There's an organization called the International Joint Commission that is U.S. and Canadian provincial and federal governments working together to govern the Great Lakes waterways. So this is something that is one of the key resources in the world. 21% of the world's fresh surface water is represented by the Great Lakes. And so it's the key resource that the United States and Canada share together. And so there's a lot of concern and a lot of history of these governments working together in the management of these resources. So I think there's a good possibility that through U.S. pressure, something can come up of it, and the Canadian government will listen and be receptive.
So what's next for you in this battle?
For me, tomorrow, my city council here in the city of Toledo is going to be considering and most likely passing a resolution in opposition to this dump. So that's our very next step here locally, and we have been mobilizing both in southeast Michigan and throughout the communities on Lake Erie in Ohio to raise the issue, because it's not very well known amongst the population down here, to bring it to people's attention. And then once it's brought to people's attention, to get the political movers and shakers to take a position on it. And so we're seeing that happening. And that's been happening in communities down through Port Huron, down through Detroit and up to the Ohio border, and the city of Oregon, which is in Ohio and borders Toledo, they passed a resolution unanimously opposing this dump. And most of these communities are doing so based on the fact that U.S. law prohibits such a dump from being anywhere near a Great Lake. That's our very next step tomorrow, is attending this Toledo City Council meeting to lend our support to this resolution that we managed to work in to the agenda.
Michael, you do such good work there in the Midwest, and I certainly know the work you've done through the Coalition Against Nukes. I wish you, and I'm certain the rest of the listeners to Nuclear Hot Seat, wish you all success in the work that you're doing to protect us from yet another piece of nuclear numbnutsery by the powers that be.
Thank you so much, Libby, and your show is wonderful, and you are an amazing person to do this week in and week out. I don't know how you do it.
Neither do I.
Greatly appreciate it.
Michael, thank you for once again being my guest on Nuclear Hot Seat.
Thank you.
That was Michael Leonardi of Toledo Coalition for Safe Energy and the Coalition Against Nukes. We'll have a radiation protection tip in just a moment, but first, I've got terrific news and something less than terrific news. The terrific first. Nuclear Hot Seat number 117 featured an interview with Arne Gunderson of Fairwinds.com about what he would do with Fukushima if he were in charge.
As you can imagine, the interview generated a lot of interest, and I give special thanks to our friends at enenews.com for promoting it with some juicy quotes. So how many downloads did it get? As of this morning, Nuclear Hot Seat number 117 has been downloaded 489,195 times. Just under 500,000 hits, and we're not done yet. Talk about getting out of the echo chamber. Woohoo! Let's celebrate! So what's the less than terrific news? The massive number of hits required bandwidth to support it, and I ran up bills thus far of just under $200 for this one episode alone. So if you'd like to support Nuclear Hot Seat, this would be a really good week to send a donation, because it will go directly to cover my Arne Gunderson Bandwidth Fund. Go to nuclearhotseat.com, scroll down on the homepage, and click on the big red donate button. Thank you. Here's the radiation protection tip. Green tea, good for your health, unless it comes from Japan, as most of it does. Take out your green tea and check on the box for the country of origin. If it comes from Japan, you might want to consider disposing of it in your nearest rad waste container and then switching to something safer to drink, like grain alcohol, fracked water. Just kidding, don't drink either of those. But for all its health benefits, green tea does not protect you from radiation, especially if it carries radiation. Here's today's final thought. 489,195 downloads? I'm not one for numbers. I don't know how to find or read my stats online. And I guess I've been afraid to learn that there are really only 47 listeners who have ever downloaded Nuclear Hot Seat, and I know every one of them by first name, if not by sight. I wouldn't have even known about this number if my auto payment to the service hadn't been so way out of line. But it appears that just under 500,000 people are so concerned about Fukushima and its consequences that they wanted to learn the exact info we covered and managed to trip over the website. So mainstream media, listen up. I know you're lurking out there. It's time. I'm looking to take Nuclear Hot Seat mainstream, be it cable, satellite, broadcast network, syndication. I am looking for a smart producer, promoter, or distributor to take this show to the next level, all serious offers considered. If I can put together a program capable of delivering just under 500,000 downloads on a podcast, think of what could be done with the support of a real distribution network that's already in place. Think of what an infusion of information from this particular nuclear perspective and what it could do to the global nuclear debate. So be it John Stewart, I'm still looking for you, John, Saturday Night Live, CNN, Sirius XM, or any other media platform, except Fox. I used to work for your guys, and so you are out of the running. But anyone else, send an email with your suggestions to info@nuclearhotseat.com, and let's get this party started. 489,195 downloads. Screw the bandwidth charges. Let's hit 500,000. This has been Nuclear Hot Seat for Wednesday, October 1st, 2013. Material for this week's program has been researched and compiled from enenews.com, Japan Daily Press, the Food and Drug Administration, fukuleaks.org, Dong-A-Ibo, National Journal, California Magazine, ncwarn.org, Toledo Blade, Cleveland Plain Dealer, mlive.com, asahi.com, channelnewsasia.com, our new friend, Takahiro Katsumi, slate.com, Bloomberg, AP, Art Bell, Huffington Post, NHK, Xinhua, Reuters, NBC Nightly News, WERU, World Nuclear News, and the Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook community. Our archive is available on iTunes or at nuclearhotseat.com/blog. Come on, mainstream media. 119 episodes, including interviews with experts on every aspect of the nuclear profile. I've done your research for you. Stake out your space in what threatens to be the most explosive story on the planet, especially as of November, when TEPCO pretends it knows how to remove fuel rods from spent fuel pool number 4. Be sure to friend me by my name or at either of the two Nuclear Hot Seat Facebook pages. Then comment, forward, retweet, do it! Nuclear Hot Seat! is the activist voice on nuclear issues, so if you have a story lead, a hot tip, or a suggestion of someone to interview, send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. We are copyright 2013, Libby Halevi and Hartestry Communications. Fair use is allowed as long as proper attribution is given to me, the program, and the website. This is Libby Halevi of Hartestry Communications, the heart of the art of communicating, reminding you that San Onofre is still shut down forever, and we've all had our nuclear wake-up call. Now, do not go back to sleep, because we are all in the nuclear hot seat.
Nuclear hot seat. It's da bomb.